It's not time yet.
Thank you for holding. She's in the office.
So what about his cough?
That time, a lot of what we discussed was domestic versus international, and how is the Fed and how is the market reacting to some of those concerns. So again, a lot of those issues are still there. It's a matter of how we digest, how is the market digesting some of these things. So domestic strength, you know, labor, unemployment, and so forth, we'll get into a little bit, and housing markets and so forth. And what we've seen most recently is some of the international factors. I mentioned here China. We'll get a little bit more into detail of what's happening. I think more importantly, why does that matter? What does it mean to the U.S.? What does it mean to global concerns as well? Some other international developments. I mentioned China, some concern over in Europe in terms of growth. We saw Japan on Friday lower their interest rate to actually negative interest rate. So what kind of impact does that have? Japan hasn't, it's always in the background somewhat, but it hasn't really been one of the headline countries in what they're doing. All of a sudden Friday comes, they make a somewhat shocking announcement to lower their interest rates further and add some more stimulus, and the market reacted pretty strongly to that. So again, what is the market doing? Why does it matter to the U.S.? We'll get into a little bit. That's clearly a huge concern of what's going on now. What does that mean? And so forth. So I think, as usual, and again, we're fixed income managers, so what the Fed is doing is always extremely important, even more so nowadays. I think it's a good barometer of the Fed decision of, they're looking at the economy. They're making their decision based on economic strength. So kind of, in a way, as the Fed goes, the markets go, and I think the economy goes, because as the economy gets stronger, the Fed gains more confidence, they're going to raise rates. So in essence, it's a pretty good barometer. And again, as fixed income managers, what the Fed is doing to rates themselves is extremely important as well. So the Fed mentioned in their Q3 meeting, I guess it was September or so, for the first time they put in some language about global concerns at the time. It was China, a little bit of Europe as well. They took that out in December when they actually went ahead and raised rates, and it looked like that fear was somewhat coming off of their table. They gained a little more confidence, there was job growth, unemployment went down. So it seemed like it was, in their minds, the right time to go ahead and raise rates. There wasn't as much volatility. January comes along, a lot of that changes. So no one really, there wasn't much expectation for a January rate hike. But even with that said, some of the language that the Fed had put in there just last week brought up that international concern again. And they basically mentioned, with the market volatility right now being the way it is, they're going to take somewhat of a step back. Let's revisit. They're not. I think what's important is they basically stated that they're aware. Of course they're aware, but they're going to put it, they're on the record that they're aware of what's going on, and they're somewhat concerned about the volatility that, that we're seeing. And a lot of that is globally driven. So again, it's that domestic versus international. You look at domestic, and GDP is growing. It's by no means hitting on all cylinders, but I think there's, for the most part, consensus that we'll have about, 2 to 2.5% GDP growth. So you look at where we came from in terms of negative growth, the economy is growing. It's not as fast as people would certainly hope for at this time, but the reality is that the economy is growing, and domestically there is certainly some strength there. It's a matter of how is that going to be impacted by other factors. Just to look, a little under the hood in terms of, what's driving that. You look at total home sales. Again, it's slowing down somewhat, but the reality is you got to look at the trend. And the trend of where we came from is certainly pretty positive. You look at just where we are right now. I know in Florida, there's certainly been some growth. I actually just closed on a home myself on Wednesday.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. We sold our old home and bought a new home in a span of about 10 days in between. So I'm on my sixth night of air mattress sleeping. So if I start rambling at some point, as I tend to do, I'm a little asleep, then hopefully you'll be a little more understanding of that. But in all honesty, that is a market that is moving. It's not certainly where it was pre-recession, but also maybe that's the way it should be. There was certainly a bubble there pre-recession, and maybe we don't want to get back to those levels. Rates are still relatively low. The Fed raised rates 25 basis points. In the reality, it's not a huge factor. Rates are still extremely low on a historical level. Just some other stats looking at the mortgage purchases in terms of new homes that are trending in the right direction for sure. Consumer confidence is high. Retail sales are rising. Again, the consumer is doing well. There's concern there for sure. I think a lot of that is just people's opinion of what's going on in the market. But under the hood, things are still growing. Some of that is, oil being as low as it is, we haven't seen as much filter through to the economy. One would think usually there's a correlation, oil goes down, you save money at the gas pump, that's going to filter through. You're going to see more people going out to dinner, more people buying, going to the mall, and so forth. We haven't seen that as much as we have historically, there's other reasons for that. But still, retail sales are still going at a fairly healthy level. I think what's interesting here is, this is just overlaying those same numbers, going back further, looking at them versus some recession eras. And you look at historically, you look at the gray shaded lines, when we've had recessions in the past, what have those numbers been doing? And you see, for the most part, there's a pretty steep decline in retail sales and consumer confidence leading into a recession, as one would think that's the case. You don't really see that here. So as bad as it seems, even going into January, as bad as things may seem at the present time, still it's not that bad. there's concern there. A lot of that is we're just coming off of an extreme bull market. So we were probably due for a correction of some sort, regardless of what some numbers may have been saying. But I think under the hood, there's still a fairly healthy level of confidence that's in the market. And compared to some other recession eras, I think we're not nearly as bad, relatively speaking. So I mentioned China. I think what's interesting is the impact we're seeing from the Chinese markets. Typically, certainly China always has an impact. The correlation we've seen lately when the Shanghai Index sells off or goes up for the day, how that's impacting the U.S. markets. And that's getting really, at this point, to an historical high. You look at the chart on the left, and this is just basically showing how much correlation of the S&P futures are there with the Shanghai Index. So you come in the morning, we're considering the time difference, we know what China's already done for the day in terms of the market. So how is the S&P reacting to those? And the reality is, as China goes, the U.S. is going these days. So I think it's important to realize why that is, and again, is that the way it should be? It's probably at this point a little bit of an overreaction in terms of how the U.S. is reacting to China, but that's just the way that it is right now, certainly for the last couple months or so. Look at the export destination for the U.S. There's globalization. We're a global economy, no doubt about that. But it's not just China. There's so many other countries that the U.S. is involved in. Look at Canada, look at Mexico, look at the whole European Union. You've got China at about 7% of U.S. exports. So they're by no means a small player, but they're not exactly ruling the whole market. Then you look at, that's just exports. Look at, okay, how much does that actually matter in terms of U.S. GDP? And you look at, even though China has grown substantially and their economy is still, even as it's slowing, it's still growing at about 6% plus. How much of that is actually impacting U.S. GDP? And the reality is, even as much as it's grown, it's still less than 1% of U.S. GDP. So the U.S. is certainly, it's a standalone economy. As much as we consider ourselves a global economy and the world matters, the impact of China itself isn't as great as I think it's showing in the markets these days. I mentioned labor market improvement, unemployment is down, jobs are growing. You look at the trend and the blue line in terms of the unemployment rate. Then you look at what the Fed is actually predicting. So the Fed is thinking rates are going to, the unemployment rate will continue to go down. I think if jobs keep growing at 250 plus every month, that's going to be probably the case. Underemployment is still pretty high. I think this shows the Fed has stated they're looking at unemployment numbers, inflation, and so forth. But they're not just looking at the headline numbers. There's other things below that. They understand that. So they look at underemployment. This is going to take the part-time and people that are basically working that are settling for lower-paying jobs. And it's still hovering around 10%. But again, you look at where we were prior to going back to the recession and so forth, it's trending in the right direction.
What's the historical number on that, would you say? Any idea?
It varies. I think in a healthy market, it's probably not that far from where it is right now. Okay. Anywhere between 8 to 10%. There's always going to be somewhat of a dispersion. It's a wider spread now between the actual unemployment and the underemployment. People are, like I said, people I think are settling for some lower paying jobs. Wages aren't growing as fast as one would hope. I think also what you're seeing is it's a shift in the dynamics of the labor force. You're seeing a lot more technology-driven jobs, and a lot of them are consultants, and they can make upwards of, in some cases, you see coders making $1,000 an hour. So they're not working 40-hour workdays anymore. It's a different type of job market, I think we're seeing. So that plays a part as well. People are choosing not to work, and it's just a different type of workforce. But yeah, the spread, I think more concerning is the spread between what the unemployment is, but
it's... Is unemployment a new measurement that came along as part of the last recession? Is this a new metric that people have developed, or we developed?
No, I mean, it goes back a little bit further than that. Okay. Yeah, it's the U6 unemployment, so it does go back to labor forces. I don't know, honestly, always has used it, but it's been going on for some time.
Yeah, it's been there, but it's never been tracked as much.
Exactly, it's the importance.
Disparity now with the part-timers that are really filtering in.
Right. It's the importance of what that is now. But yeah, I think it's always been tracked somewhat. What's interesting is, historically, when the Fed has raised rates, they've inflation, unemployment, and so forth have hit a certain level, and then they've waited a little bit of time, and then they've raised rates. What we're seeing now is they're doing more of a forecast, especially in terms of inflation, where they're saying, we want inflation to hit 2%. But we project that we're pretty comfortable that that's going to happen based on how unemployment has been falling. And historically, as the unemployment rate falls, inflation does start to kick in. So what this is basically showing us is we're at the point now where historically inflation starts to kick in a little bit. And they want to get to that 2% level. That has not really been the case so much. And that's a lot of that is commodity induced, as we're seeing in oil and other commodity prices. That's dragging inflation down. So it's always important to look at history, and I think the Fed uses that as a key determination of what they're going to do. I think the reality is this is not so much like other time periods for various reasons. But historically, what we've seen is as we reach these levels of unemployment and wages will start to kick in, which we've seen a little bit, and inflation will start to kick in. And the Fed is somewhat hinging on that, maybe a little bit too much than they should be, but they're really basing it on that level of unemployment. As you see here, on the left of where the target is in terms of core inflation, we're still below that. We're trending there. We're getting there slowly. You see on the right, wages are moving up. That is one determination that has been slightly positive. Again, not to the degree that the Fed and just people in general are hoping for, but it's getting there. I mentioned oil. That's a drag on inflation. You've seen, again, similar to China, you've seen a direct correlation between oil prices and the stock market especially. And that's typically not really been the case. You think, again, oil goes down, that's a positive for consumers. That's going to be somewhat of an inverse correlation to the stock market. The stock market will go up historically. Has not really been the case there. Usually it's, in this case, it's really more of a supply issue. Some cases it would say it's a demand issue and like less demand would drag prices down, which is, there's some of that as well. But you've seen really an interesting supply issue in terms of other countries just really, the glut of oil that's out there, other countries just continuing to produce oil. And there's a lot of reasons for that, OPEC, non-OPEC countries, some of the reasons why they're trying to keep that price down. But oil is really struggling right now, and this is at the end, 37 at the end of the year, hit as far, I think as low as 26 at some point. How much lower can it go? It's come up a little bit since then. How much lower can it really go? How much more of an impact can it really have? And I think what you see on the right is showing that whereas once energy was 10% of capital expenditures, now it's only 5%. So in some ways, the impact that could have been felt has been felt.
With the oil down, it also affects the jobs.
Yes. Well, specifically in the energy, and you've seen, for instance, in the high yield market, you've seen a huge sell-off. A lot of that is energy based. That industry for sure is going to feel a lot of pain.
It affects tax revenue or municipalities too.
Yes, right. Absolutely. If it's tied to gas prices, absolutely. There's positive and there's negatives. Usually some of the negatives are outweighed by the fact that you have, your everyday person has more money in their pocket and that's going to filter through. That hasn't happened so much. I think a lot of that is a confidence issue. It goes back to jobs and wages and so forth. But if people aren't necessarily making more money and they're concerned, some of that is probably news driven. People get scared. The market has a huge correction in a couple of weeks and people get scared and they don't want to spend the money. It's certainly understandable. So that hasn't, the negatives have really outweighed the positives, as you typically would see. But as I mentioned, it's had a huge impact already. If oil is at 26, how much lower can it really go? And how much more of an impact can it really have at this point? This is just kind of an idea of what the Fed is seeing going forward. Again, growth, you know, in the 2%, you know, low 2%, so nothing that's going to jump off the charts, but steady, consistent, you know, slow growth. Unemployment continued to come down up to that, they have it at 4.7%. More importantly, they have inflation picking up pretty quickly up to their 2% level. Again, that's, you know, that's what they're hoping for. Some of that's going to be commodities coming back in their minds. But it's probably a little bit of a steep projection, but that's the way they see things. And I think that's important to consider when you're thinking about how, you know, how quickly are they going to raise rates. So this is, I think we mentioned before, this is the Fed dots of the Fed governors, where they see rates going. Some are more hawkish and see rates getting higher. Some are more dovish and see rates being a little bit depressed. But even those that are fairly dovish and don't see rates going too, you know, high too fast, I think what's important is the actual trend of these dots. Even the most dovish person has rates going up. So you take a diagonal line, you go right through the middle of these dots, so to speak, and you still see rates that are increasing at a pretty steady level. The market is a little bit more skeptical. The Fed is pricing in 4 interest rate hikes for 2016. I don't think anybody really thinks that's going to happen, especially after January. The market was pricing in 2 interest rate hikes as of about a week ago. That's come down even from there. But you know, I still think once the markets calm down a little bit and things get a little bit more on solid footing, that people will expect, you know, at least a rate hike or two. It's not really a matter of once they got off that first rate hike, it became probably not so much a matter of if they're going to hike again. It's a matter of when and more importantly, how frequently. What is the pace of rates going to be going forward, the rate hikes going to be going forward. So with that in mind, I was going to jump a little bit into our portfolio and some of our positioning. I touched on a lot of our thinking, I guess, in terms of how we see rates moving and what the economy is doing. But just to sum up, I guess, we're cautiously optimistic in terms of the economy. We think a lot of the international factors, we don't by no means want to push them aside. They're important things. It's a global economy, and they're going to have it, as we're learning, they're going to have an impact on what the U.S. is doing. But we do think a lot of that is some overreaction. We were due for a correction. We still think, you know, under the hood, the economy is still strong. Just as important, the Fed believes the economy is still pretty strong, and they have caveats in terms of inflation being depressed and some of the global concerns, but you kind of read into their language a little bit, and it seems like they do want to move, they want to do some rate hikes, they want to move forward and start the process a little bit further, but they're going to take a step back and do it the right way. And again, it's coming down to what is the pace of hikes going to be. So, and that's going to benefit us in terms of our portfolio. In terms of the fourth quarter, it was a strong quarter for us. You see, the index was down about 54 basis points. We were down 25. As we've been for some time, I'm sure everyone's aware, we've been short duration, expecting, you know, somewhat of rates going up. We want to, you know, keep ourselves protected, stay somewhat conservative in that type of environment. The barbell structure that we have in terms of being long the front end and long the belly of the curve a little bit longer, that helped us as well. We saw a flattening of the curve. So it wasn't that just that rates went up, it's how the yield curve reacts. With the short-term rates are heavily dependent on what the Fed is doing. So as the Fed moved, the short-term rates will come up. We have floating rate positions that are there, that are gonna reset at higher rates, so that's gonna benefit us. In addition, the long end didn't move up as much, and that's gonna benefit us as well. And as I mentioned, a lot of that is the pace of rate hikes. As people get more concerned or somewhat pessimistic in terms of the pace of how quickly they're gonna move, that long end of the curve isn't going to move up as much as that short end may, and that's going to benefit us in terms of how we're positioned. We're overweight credit. There's some yield pickup there. We're going to counter from being short duration, but we expect that to continue. We're cautiously bullish on the economy and the high quality names that we're in specifically. We're pretty optimistic about. So we're going to protect ourselves by being in those high quality names. That even if there is a bit of a correction there, they're not going to widen out as much as some of the more risky names would. That's just kind of the mentality that we have. Security selection, that's actually a typo. That should be in the what helped column. So it's not just a matter of we were overweight credit did well. It's more specifically we were overweight the right credits, so to speak. We didn't just choose company A and B. We said company A looks better relative to company B. Let's invest in that. And that actually, you know, that was an outperformance for us as well. we have, you know, we have a cap of 50% in terms of the investment policy, in terms of corporates, but we're a little bit more overweight in some other portfolios that we're closer to flat in terms of the index. But some of that is just, you know, how much more we overweight credit, which outperformed, and more, a little bit more weighted towards that security selection. But still, considering that what we expected and how rates did, it's our job, we believe, in that type of environment to lose less money to protect your principal. So we think, considering, you know, the benchmark was now about 55 basis points, for us to outperform by 30 basis points was, you know, was pretty positive for the month.
Dave, do you have direct exposure to the oil patch?
Very little. We have very little. We've sold whatever we did have, and anything we have is more, we've avoided the refiners. So anything that's directly impacted by oil price, we're not going to get involved in. Not the refiners, so much of the drillers we've avoided. That's going to be directly impacted by what oil is doing. They're making less, you know, less spread on oil prices. They're going to, a lot of them we've seen are going to go out of business. And even if they're, even the healthy ones are going to get impacted just by being in that industry. So what we've done is, if we are involved, we're more involved with the refiners, which aren't really, all they're doing is just converting it. They're not really, the oil price themselves isn't as important to them. With that said, anything attached to energy at this point is, it's going to get hurt. So we've done a pretty good job of really anything we did hold. We've been underweight for quite some time. Anything we did hold, we pretty much got out of, because it's not an industry you really want to be involved in at some point. Now with that said, with spreads widening as they have, there is a point where it's, you know, you have to say, okay, well, let's look here. Like this is probably a little bit over-exaggerated. There's something we like here. Let's jump in here a little bit. So I think we're doing some research now on what makes sense to get into. That, you know, there's companies out there that just rent oil rigs to the companies. So again, that's not gonna, if one company goes out of business, that's a driller, someone's gonna take their place. You know, there's oil there to be had, someone's gonna go for it, someone's gonna drill for it. So there's companies out there that just rent this equipment to them. So they theoretically shouldn't be as impacted as the drillers would be. But again, they're gonna get hurt just by being attached to the industry. So I think we probably will at some point jump in a little bit and add a little bit of exposure. Nothing too issue, because it's tough right now, because oil, as low as it is, it's not really so much of an impetus of where it's going to go up. You know, supply is continuing to flood the market. Demand is not very high. So, you know, in the 20s, it's probably, you know, it's certainly low, and it probably shouldn't be that low. But, you know, I don't know what's going to push it to 50 or something like that. There's no direct impetus that's going to push it forward in the near term, at least. So I think we'll probably just dabble at most. But by being underweight for sure in the fourth quarter and last year, it helped us a lot. Just looking at some of the performance numbers, so including the quarter, if you look at a, you know, 3-5, 10-year basis and so forth, we're still, you know, outperforming the benchmark. This is just really just giving some out of review, which I already went over in terms of what hurt us, what helped us. You know, just some attributes, as you mentioned, we're short duration. We're pretty consistent with how we've held our position. For some time, we've been fairly conservative, expecting that the Fed to hike rates. If that doesn't happen, as we've seen it, you know, the January reaction, I think we, by being overweight credit and by being positioned in a certain way, that's going to outbalance if we get that bet wrong. But again, we'd rather be wrong, you know, by the Fed not moving, than if the Fed moves drastically and we could lose a substantial amount of money. In our minds, the Fed not moving, rates will stay, you know, they'll go up, they'll go down, but they generally will stay in the same area. We think most managers will be kind of, you know, performance will be pretty close together, and that's okay in that type of environment. Well, our concern is if the Fed starts to hike rates a little bit and quicker than people expect, or even if it's just one or two times this year, you know, most people see rates going up to some degree. So in our mind, it's just more—it's more important to just not lose principal in that case. And I think that, as far as compliance goes, we're in compliance as we always strive to be. And just the holdings. Any questions?
Good report. Appreciate it.
So we need a motion to accept the Salgrass report.
Second.
All in favor?
All right,
now we're here on the site.
Okay. I'll just provide a few general comments. Obviously, the economy is what it is. It's, you know, for the most part, our views are consistent with Sawgrass's, and I'm sure PFM's as well. I would say at the margin, we're a little less positive on the actual economic story for the U.S. And when, you know, when we came into this year, you know, we started looking at 2016 and learned a little bit about what happened in 2015. And, you know, we are generally concerned about the global story a little bit more, having more of an impact on the U.S. You know, we think China, you know, if their GDP comes in at 6.8 or 6.9, is it really 6.8 or is it 2.8? The fact is that, you know, they're so used to strong growth rates that anything less than 7% is pretty much considered to be weak. So we think that's going to have a bigger impact globally on commodities. And as David said, you know, we are a global economy, the U.S. much more so than we were 10 years ago. When we had the Great Recession of 2008, China acted as a global shock absorber. They continued to grow with very strong levels, and they absorbed a lot of the excess capacity that was created in some of the Western countries. They signaled last year when they devalued their currency that they're no longer in the position of being the global economic shock absorber. And since then, you know, we've seen continued weakness in the Chinese currency and then related currencies that, the sort of satellite nations around China. So we think China, this growth story, commodities, obviously, you've seen what's happened so far this year with commodities. And then really the impact on the U.S. dollar. U.S. dollar continues to strengthen against basically all global currencies. You know, so what does that mean? We think that generally in the macro sense that's going to be weak, all things being equal. It's a weaker story for the U.S. economy. So I think you've probably heard us say over the last really 2 years now that we felt like interest rates in general were going to remain lower for longer. And we think that that's going to be intact. That story's intact. Now, when we talk about rates, you know, we're a little bit further out the curve, as you know. You know, we think about it in terms of, you know, 5 to 10 year part of the curve, and even longer, 10 to 30 year part of the curve when we talk about rates being lower for longer. They've mentioned, you know, the Fed can control short-term rates, but the market's going to control longer-term rates. And what are we seeing globally with longer-term rates, or even short-term rates for that matter? You know, 14 European bond markets have negative two-year yields. It's, you know, it's a phenomenon that we've never seen before. 19 European bond markets have 10-year yields that are below U.S. Treasury yields. So we look at that and we say, the U.S. is probably one of the strongest economies around the globe. 2%, not saying much, 2% GDP growth. And we out-yield our European counterparties. So where's the capital going to flow? It's going to flow, continue to flow to the United States. That'll continue to strengthen the dollar, okay, and it's going to keep a lid on longer-term rates. What we've seen recently is the Federal Reserve, you know, forecasting 4 rate hikes this year, but the market really backing out. And as of Friday, actually, I was writing my commentary. You'll probably get it the next day or so. But the Fed funds futures, which is the market's forecast for Fed funds, actually has less than one hike. Basically, it's 0 hikes for the year, for all of 2016. So the market's betting no rate hikes. The Fed is saying 4 rate hikes. We think it's probably somewhere in between, but maybe 1 or 2 rate hikes. But what does that mean for the longer term, you know, 5 or 10 year? We don't think it's going to affect longer term rates all that much because those macro factors will continue to be in play. So, and we think actually getting beyond this year, that those global influences on inflation, weak economic activity, lower commodity prices, they're really disinflationary forces. So even though the Fed can say we want inflation to be at 2%, how long have they been trying to get inflation up? 7 years, 8 years? A long time. And they're pushing on a string. It's just not working because of all these global forces. So what did we hear? You know, we hear Japan, Bank of Japan, talk about negative interest rates. We heard Greenspan over the weekend come out and say, well, you know, the U.S. Fed, they'll think about, I guarantee you they've been thinking about negative interest rates in the U.S. and what would happen for them to implement a negative interest rate in the U.S. There are three European countries that have negative deposit rates already. So it's something that as bond managers we have to think about as a possibility. What does that mean? I think what it means generally for you is, unfortunately, lower interest. You know, like we've seen the last couple of years, 2-3% interest in your longer term portfolio. So. We're not calling for a recession, but we think that, you know, I think it was something I read this weekend, the U.S. economy, it was the weakest 10-year cumulative growth rates since the Depression, the last 10 years in the U.S. economy, which is extremely, of course, you know, we had 2007 and 8, which were extremely weak. But we've never really seen the growth rates that you would expect. So combined together, it's the weakest 10-year period. And remember, we used to talk about the lost decade in Japan. Well, Japan's in the lost second decade of economic growth. And so, we're not saying that growth is going to be negative. We just think, you know, I think we're going to have to get used to these types of modest returns in a longer-term portfolio. So what does that mean for your portfolio, how we're positioned? We continue to be, let me just talk about positioning, somewhat cautiously positioned. You know, we're duration neutral, so our duration is pretty much in line with the benchmark at 4.1 years. Yield to maturity, you know, a little over 2%. That's come up a little bit. High credit quality. Pretty good weighting in treasuries, about 32% on a duration basis. But we're underweight credit. We've been reducing our credit exposure there over the last couple of quarters. Concerned about credit spreads widening, which they have done. And then really being a safe haven investment is in the securitized space. High quality, AAA rated, mortgage-backed securities with shorter durations, good convexity. And so essentially we're hiding out in a high quality defensive portfolio. What are some of the things that helped in the portfolio? The yield curve flattening, we did have a little bit of a yield curve flattening trade on, a little bit overweight the longer, you know, 5 to 10 year part of the curve as the short end adjusted for the Fed rate hike. Security selection was a positive contributor. But sector allocation was a detractor to the performance in the portfolio, and I'll show you in a minute why. But you can see returns pretty much consistent with the benchmark, which is not a surprise. We're very much index-like in our portfolio. But you can see 3-year returns, a little over 1.5. You know, 5-year returns, 2.75. I just think that's the type of return expectation you should continue to have in this portfolio. I would say two of the areas that hurt us in the last quarter, relatively speaking, relative to the benchmark, finance, banks and brokerage did pretty well. We were underweight the finance sector and industrials. So I'll jump to John's question. He's probably going to ask me, did we have any exposure to energy? We did have some related exposure to energy. We're again, underweight the benchmark, but we did have some names. We like the sort of midstream pipes where it's fee-based services. So you're not directly related to the price of oil, but obviously, you know, large E&Ps are cutting back production and cutting back expenses. So, you know, we were impacted by that. We do think that those prices have bottomed for those types of bonds. And we think that that's going to be a turnaround story for 2016. We own the highest quality names in that space. And there will be some consolidation in the energy sector. Obviously, we've already seen, you know, some bankruptcies, and we think there will be a period where some of these companies will be wiped out, and there'll be some consolidation, mergers, and acquisitions. And so we want to own the names that are going to be survivors at the end of that. So we think that's probably late 2016 sort of turnaround story. And then you can see the securitized at 44%. Which has been a good, very strong defensive space to be in this kind of environment. Compliance monitor, everything in compliance, as again, as you would expect, and no issues.
I have a question for you.
Yes.
In the environment we're anticipating moving forward, is there anything about the constraints in our investment policy that inhibited you in any way, or is there anything you would like to see different or change?
Well, we think
from the standpoint of your discipline.
Yeah, from our discipline, I would say, you know, credit is going to be, we're going to see an opportunity to add credit at some point. If you look at it on a spread basis, we began last year about 130 investment grade space. You know, we've widened 60 basis points since then. So we think that there will be an opportunity to add credit you know, at some point in 2016. We think there's some more widening to take place there, but you know, the way Sykes manages portfolios is we look at the credit cycle, not necessarily the interest rate cycle. So we get really underweight at the end of the cycle as credit spreads begin to widen, and then we get really overweight credit when we think the valuations give us very good value. And so at that point, you know, we would say, okay, let's load up on credit, and we might want to be higher than the maximum, but that would be the only area that I would say.
That was off, if I'm reading the chart right, your current limit is 50.
Right. So you know, it would be maybe, you know, if we overweight, we would be overweight. We could be overweight two times the index, which we've been overweight in other portfolios that don't have that cap, you know, 2.2 times the index. That would be the only opportunity. You see how much room we have already. We're only at 17.6,
right,
which again is where we've underweight as credit spreads have widened at the end of the cycle. And then when the cycle turns, which has already begun to turn, you know, we then, if we look for a period where we're peaking, credit spreads are peaked, and we would increase that exposure by 2.2 times. That would be the only area of that I would say. Any questions for me?
Thank you. No. For the report.
Thank you. All right. We need a motion to second. All in favor?
Aye.
Now we're on the PFM. Yes.
All right. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
First off, I just wanted to say Steve sends his regrets. He is actually doing some continuing education this morning and couldn't be here with you, so he apologizes for that. Can everybody see my presentation in front of them?
Yes.
I'm sorry?
Yes.
Okay, good. Okay. Well, I guess I can be very brief on my economic comments. I did expect to hear a little bit more of a cheer with regard to the Fed's decision to increase rates in the fourth quarter, at least for us guys on the short end of the curve, was very much welcome, as we anticipate seeing a little bit of an increase in income for our clients going forward. So we were thrilled to see it. I would say our comments definitely echo what Sawgrass and Sykes had to say. I agree, fourth quarter does feel like a decade ago. But what is important in the fourth quarter, as Sawgrass mentioned, is still important today. So I heard Sawgrass say they're cautiously optimistic. I heard Sykes say they're less optimistic and concerned with what's going on in the global economy. Again, I think our view is very consistent with both of these firms. You know, I guess the good news with regard to the U.S. is that we are less reliant on China. I think they only make up about 1.6% of our overall growth. So we're less concerned about what the impact it has on us directly in the U.S., but we're definitely monitoring what it's doing to the global economy, as we are reliant on the global economy for our growth and our trading partners. So it's definitely something we continue to focus on. Everybody's touched on where they think rates are going. I'd say we're in the same camp. You know, the Fed says 4 rates. The market early on implied 2 to 3. It now implies basically, as Sykes mentioned, really not even 1 for this year. We've been in the camp of 2 to 3 this year. Nothing at this point changes that outlook. So, you know, with that said, you know, interest rates rose during the quarter. You see the 10-year rose by about 23 basis points, the 2-year to about 42 basis points. You can see that graphically here in the upper right-hand corner. The solid blue line is the end of the fourth quarter, the dotted gray, the end of the third quarter. And then you can see it quantitatively here. So the 2-year up by about 42 basis points, 1-year up 29. And that's the area of the curve where we're playing. So, you know, what does that mean? Well, interest rates go up, bond prices down. It was a tough quarter for fixed income. Treasury's down about negative 0.44% during the quarter, and agencies down about 0.37% during the quarter. You see, it was, on a relative basis, a pretty good quarter for credit. You've heard both managers talk about their stance on credit. We're probably more in line with Sawgrass. We are a little bit more bullish on credit. It's an area that we have focused on, an area where we've had success. You can see it was a very good quarter for agency mortgage backs as interest rates increased, the threat of prepayment risk decreased, and agency MBS outperformed. Not a bad quarter for munis either. You have some exposure in your portfolio there as well. So let's get into the actual portfolio, what you're most concerned in seeing. By way of review, again, you do have exposure to treasuries, agencies, mortgage backs, high quality corporate, commercial paper, and muni, so you're well diversified. And it was a quarter in which diversification definitely benefited you. We ended the quarter with a market value of $50,695,000. That's down from the previous quarter end at $50,800,000. And that's on performance of a negative 0.21% versus a negative 0.43% for the benchmark. That 20-some-odd basis points of outperformance can be attributed to the short duration stance we took during the quarter in anticipation of the Fed's actions to increase rates. And we talked about the fact that 2-year was up about 42 basis points. That short duration stance basically meant that we didn't fully participate in that down market, and you can again see that reflected in your performance. After the Fed's move, we did lengthen duration, so we are now sort of in the Sykes camp, and we're more of a neutral from a duration standpoint relative to the benchmark at 1.78 years versus 1.79 years, again roughly 100%. Or neutral benchmark. We also can see the impact in yields reflected here with the higher yield to maturity of market now versus the previous quarter end at 1.28 and a yield to maturity cost of 1.17%. from an attribution standpoint. Again, diversification definitely benefited you all this quarter. You can see commercial paper and corporate names were definitely additive on a relative basis to performance. You'll note that Seaway corporates actually were the best performing part of the corporate credit quality spectrum. But again, being diversified from an attribution standpoint was definitely beneficial this past quarter. This is a snapshot of how the portfolio is positioned at the end of the fourth quarter. Again, like Sykes, you know, we have roughly about 34% in treasuries, another 4.4% in agencies. And I think what I'll point out, too, is nothing drastically different versus the previous quarter end. We are a little bit heavier in corporate notes. I'll talk about some of the names we added there in a second. But again, the other thing to take away is very high credit quality. Portfolio, again, well diversified. So some of the names we added in corporates during the course of the quarter, in the BBB space, B of A, Goldman Sachs, and Citigroup were added. And then in the AAA space, we hold names like, I've heard a consistent question around energy names. We do have some exposure in energy, very little, I might add. We own Exxon as well as ConocoPhillips. Exxon is a AAA name, and we probably own 1.25 million in that name, and only about 250,000 in ConocoPhillips. So, you know, we're hovering around, 1% of the portfolio in energy names. But, again, very high-quality names at that. So here we give you a little bit of a snapshot of the maturity distribution. The blue line is the end of the fourth quarter. The orange line is the end of the third quarter. And then we also give you some of your investment policy statistics here in the upper right-hand corner. So I mentioned the fact that we were short duration versus the benchmark during the majority of the fourth quarter and then lengthened out at the end of the fourth quarter. And that's reflected here in these larger or higher bars in the 2 to 3 to 4 year space. So again, we went short majority of the quarter, we lengthened a little bit at the end, and you see it here in the 2 to 3, 3 to 4 year space. From a policy standpoint, again, you're well within the policy guidelines. You know, securities within the portfolio longer than 7 years, there are none. The effective maturity longer than 3 years, less than 50%, you're well within that, 12.6% today. The next four statistics are around duration and having to be within 60 to 120% of the benchmark. You can see, I mentioned earlier, you stand at about 99% today at 1.78 versus 1.79 for the benchmark, so you're well within that guideline. And then the average effective maturity, about 1.91 years, well within that limit of being less than 4 years. So no policy issues from a maturity duration issue. We drill down a little further on the next page, and we break down those maturity buckets into quarter-year increments. And we're looking at your portfolio in blue here versus the benchmark in orange. So this isn't a previous quarter end versus current quarter end. It's your portfolio relative to the benchmark and allows you to see where we're finding value along the yield curve. Like Sawgrass, I guess you could kind of classify this into a barbell type strategy in that we are overweight the long end, we're overweight the short end. We are carrying a little bit of an overweight here in the belly of the curve as well, but I guess if you had to classify it, we'll call a barbell being long here on the long end and or overweight on the long end and overweight on the short end. But you know, this exposure is really just to take advantage of the steepness of the yield curve and take advantage of being able to roll down the curve. The last item I'll touch on, and I'll open it up to any questions, that we always include this asset allocation slide. It allows you to quickly look at your portfolio relative to the limit set by your policy. We do it at the sector level on this page. We do it at the security level on this page. But it's a quick way for you to determine whether or not you're within the guidelines set by your policy. You have specific guidelines around maximums to treasury agencies and instrumentalities. Minimum required at 35% there. Today, you're at roughly 54%, so again, within that guideline. From a mortgage-backed, instrumentality mortgage-backed standpoint, you can't have more than 100%. Today, you're at about 20.44%. And then lastly, a combined total within CP, corporate notes, and banker's acceptance cannot exceed 50%. The combined total at the end of December was about 42%. So again, no policy issues. If you had any, you know, if you would have a no in that far right column, and I promise you we'd be having a conversation well in advance of this meeting to talk about why you're out of compliance and then the steps being taken to bring you back in compliance. But I point you to these pages. It should be some of the first that you look at when you get your presentation from us. With that, I will see if there are any questions. And if not, I just want to thank you for your continued business and just know that we take nothing for granted. If there's anything we can be doing better, we ask that you share that with us.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. I need a motion to approve PFM's report.
Second. So moved.
All in favor?
Aye.
All right. All right. John. We're here for the Cap Trust.
Do I need that?
Yes.
All right, it's kind of hard for me to see that from here, so I'm going to translate to paper.
Yeah.
So get a little rough, you'll understand. But that is the pie chart, and that shows the overall allocation of the total portfolio, including your cash assets. So we have $178.5 million with the three managers. They're, again, just as a reminder, they're broken down into components of 30% to Sawgrass, and approximately 20% or so to PFM and Sites. Money market has $66,000 of assets broken into three components, Florida local government, Florida Prime, and SunTrust checking account, for a total asset base of $244,900,000. This is the combined composite page showing the actual total return of the portfolio. Up in the upper left-hand corner, you can see, again, this is just for the managers, you can see that the beginning value was $179 million. There were approximately $38,000 of net flow positive, investment losses of $533,000, for a total of ending value of $178,586,281. You can see that the target allocation on the right-hand side for the managed portfolio is 40% to Sawgrass, 30% to PFM, and 30% to Sites. Looking down on the next block of information, you have the account value and returns for the trailing one-year period. That is, again, the calendar year in this particular instance. The return was 96 basis points. And the policy was 96 basis points, again, remembering that this is net of fees. So you're actually right on the policy net of fees, which is pretty good. Could be worse. On the next block of information, you had your quarterly return for the account, which was negative 0.30 basis points against the policy return of negative 0.49. That's a positive differential of 20 basis points. That number also applies for the year-to-date, the fiscal year-to-date, which, of course, is just the fourth quarter. Overall, for the one-year, three-year, and five-year periods, you have been doing well in terms of returns and up markets, and you're only capturing a smaller amount of downside on your down markets. On the next page, I know this is really hard to see, but so I'll just tell you the story, just the big story, and that is that your portfolio, if you look at it in terms of risk versus return, your portfolio is falling into the upper left-hand corner of those matrices for all of the periods demonstrated. And that is, of course, a positive place. That's where you want to be. So if a picture tells 1,000 words, and this picture doesn't because you can't see it. that's the story. So that is a good positive story there. Finally, I wanted to just go over composite returns in terms of a graphic here. And you can see up in the upper part of the page, we're dealing with very small numbers here, of course. But you're showing since inception a performance above the benchmark, again, in relationship after all fees and expenses. And that continues throughout the graph. You can see that the total portfolio return was negative 30 basis points, and it beat the policy fairly handily, although you kind of fell a little lower in terms of the universe. And the reason for that is that your universe for the entire portfolio is quite short. And we have some long manager in there, so we don't look as strong in a period of rising rates. But otherwise, the managers have all done well, and you can see on the page that even net of fees, they've all outperformed the benchmarks. One thing I do want to note is in the last time I was here, we actually did this report based upon managers' returns. This time we were able to go back to the actual statements directly from BN1 Mellon. There are still a few small anomalies, but not so much that we felt that it really hurt the integrity of the report. So we're back on schedule in that sense. That doesn't mean all things are well, but it's just a little bit better than it has been. So that's basically the report, and unless there are any questions.
Any questions?
No.
Can I get a motion to approve?
I'll make a motion.
Motion.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
All right. All right. Maribel, you want to? Well, that would have worked.
I can even see that.
Yeah.
That's good.
Need more practice on this. Sorry for that. Okay, here you go. Okay, my presentation here is our portfolio daily fund is around 66 million. SunTrust is reporting 40 million, which is about a 17% allocation of the overall portfolio with an interest of 15 basis points. We have 24 million in a state board of administration, which is 10% of the overall portfolio and has a 35 basis point return. There is also 2 million in Florida local government, which has a 8 basis point return. Also, you can see in this report compared to the last quarter that we don't have any information for Florida Safe. It's not longer reported here. The reason why, because the return was constant at 10 basis point, and comparing them with the state board and the Florida local government return, the decision was made to transfer the money to SunTrust investment account until further instructions. So this is the end of my report. Any questions?
So Florida local government trust has a minus.
Yes.
Is that cost of expenses or where is that?
I'm not quite sure on that one. Please, someone can tell me on that.
Yeah, I'm looking at that.
Okay.
All right. So that one is really just for information. The only other thing we have is a custody agreement, which is going to council tomorrow. The plan there is by March 1st to have everything moved. I think Wells Fargo's talked to everybody. So that's in motion. So hopefully council approves that and we can move forward.
Okay.
Any other issues?
Very important, appreciate the information.
Thank you. I just kind of got one question, there's a common theme there in all of them about sort of avoiding energy. And looking at PFNs, like they had 1.4 or something like that percent in Exxon with an allowable allocation of 5. Isn't there some opportunities with a AAA there if we're going to manage it for the total return basis on those things to increase that to about, in those companies? Looks like we're underweighting them because of what's going on, but I mean, we're almost some ways at the bottom. And isn't there some better opportunities there to kind of increase our, if we're going to hold it to maturity, we should be able to pick up a better total return basis. And I'm not sure why everybody's avoiding it.
I would say, you know, when Sykes looks at things, we would not necessarily disagree. And that's, I was sort of saying, we're looking for those opportunities. I mean, we're not in the business, I don't think any of us are, of picking the bottom on energy or picking a bottom on gold or anything like that. But when we look at the fundamentals of some of these companies that are very high quality, we would say that we see opportunities.
Yeah. And I mean, if it was to your point, I would definitely, you know,
right.
I mean, that's really having havoc on the high yield market, but it just seems like looking at the allocations, and we're allowed to go to 5%, we're really truly underweighting something.
I think in a dream scenario or in a personal account, to your point about holding to maturity, yes.
And I give a personal, that's the whole problem, I suppose.
Yeah, I think there's certainly opportunities, right? At the ultimate maturity, you can get a pretty, you know, a pretty good yield on a AAA piece of paper. We have to mark to market, so we do have to ride out some of the, you know, some of the, for us, it's right, we don't want to, We're not in the business of necessarily picking the bottom. We're, you know, we're definitely monitoring not just the triple names, but even names that are hobbled into the triple B space, and we tend to be underweight there. But if there's opportunities there, and we can even add, you know, we're not going to put 5% in per se, but if we can add 1% or even 0.5%, we think we could pick something up. Sure, we will definitely we'll look at that. But it's a tough space right now, and you know, we don't need to be the first ones to get in.
Yeah, and I got respect for it. I'm just, you know, asking why. Something like that, that he pointed out that we hold Exxon, which is AAA, then we look at it, we're really underweighted our allotted allocation. And maybe it's not there, you know.
It's, you mentioned, it's, you know, it's maybe a later in the year or as all
yeah, yeah.
It's a little, but yes, but there definitely is a story there. And I think as time goes on, once, it's hard to figure out right now because there's so many things that don't necessarily make sense in the market. I mentioned the oil and the equity markets and the correlation there. You got to kind of weed it out and see once things calm down, what it make a little bit more sense, and then get into names. But if I was buying some bonds in a personal account and there's some paper there that you go to maturity, I think, yeah.
I mean, they still could be overpriced, I don't know. I'm just looking at percentages that were so underweighted in that.
Yeah.
Where would you think the next energy, where would you, do you think, what sector might offer the best upside opportunity right now? Give me ideas.
They've done very well, but I think banks really have been an overreaction there in terms of how much they've even sold off. Rates are still pretty low, so they're not able to make as much money as they historically would, but the things they've had to do in terms of getting their balance sheets healthy, and some of the capital ratios that they need to hold now, I know PFM mentioned some of the names they're getting into. These aren't, you know, their names everyone recognizes, and there's nothing, you know, they're not necessarily doing anything different, but they've had, with low rates, I think with a fear somewhat of some of the banks, and just an overall sell-off, I think what we've done is just look at, we're going to get into high quality, added to, you know, the regional banks are a little bit, it can be a little bit iffy, there's some plays there, but they're, you know, they're a little bit more noise there you want to avoid, but some of the money center banks, like the Goldman's, the B of A's, and, you know, the Morgan Stanley, that have some recurring revenue, and then have extremely healthy capital ratios. There's just, I never want to say there's no risk there, but I think they're very safe in that. They offer a high quality, healthy return. So that's, I think we feel comfortable. An industry we feel pretty healthy, pretty comfortable with.
Anything else?
Yep.
All right, we're adjourned.
Thank you everyone.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you very much. Good week.
You too.
Thank you. All right.
Thank you.
You dialed the station.
That is your first time. A few glitches.
Okay, see you all later. Take care, good.
Thank you.
Take care.
Battery. Yes, let me plug in that back again. Yes, you can plug this in.
Thank you. See you next quarter.
Hey, you guys. See you next quarter.
Thank you.
Take care.